Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Robert Storr, curator, critic, painter. From 1990 until 2002, he worked at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where he was curator and then senior curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture. We're talking about his book, Robert Storr, Interviews on Art. Rob, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, as the audience knows, I interview artists all the time and people in the arts, curators. But I also interview scientists and historians, basically nonfiction authors. So I found this book not only fascinating for what the artist said, which was a lot, but about what you said and how you framed questions. When you talk to artists, it's a very different kind of interview. Would you agree?
Yes, it is. But it's not because they're artists per se. It's really my style in general. Because if I was talking to a scientist or historian, I might phrase the questions differently. But my overall attitude is that the reason you interview people is that you want to find something out. You want to know something you don't know. And I think the tendency in many cases is to take people with published opinions and use an interview to challenge those opinions prosecutorially.
But it's never a gotcha interview.
It's never a gotcha. I'm not interested in that. There's no point in that.
Yeah, I'm the same. And when I started this show 20 years ago, I made it a point to never do that. You talk about interviewing is about psychology. It's about establishing a relationship. Now, a lot of your interviews exist over longer periods of time. I have like 25 minutes, and that's a short period of time to try to establish a relationship. But it is important. How do you do that?
Well, I can't speak for you, but in a way, I start the conversation in my head before I even meet the person.
I'm the same. I'm absolutely the same.
Like I'm talking to myself, except I'm not. I'm talking to somebody else in my head. And then when the interview starts, I just pick up the conversation wherever my head is at that moment in relation to the person who's my interlocutor.
And you have to really want to know. I never fake an interview. I really want to know what these people think. I really want to know how they see the world.
As do I. And there are real surprises if you allow that to happen.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about some of your interviews in just a second. Some of the interviews in this book are amazing because they're very long. And some of them occurred over years. I think about the interviews you did with Louise Bourgeois. That's an amazing series of interviews.
Well, I had a 30-year relationship with her. And she has tapes of our talking that I had never heard. So there's more to come someday, maybe, if her assistant sees fit. But the point is that, you know, she was a mysterious woman to herself, not to mention the people outside. So conversation was a kind of self-analysis.
But you mentioned in the introduction that there was a point where she thinks that you found out something about her personal life and that may have changed the nature of the relationship a bit.
Well, I'm sure that that's the case here. I was in Chile as a representative of the Museum of Modern Art, and I went to the National Gallery in Chile, and I met her, a man who was then the director, who had been the director at the time that Pinochet took over, and who'd been very valiant in protecting artists who hid in the storage spaces of the museum and so on. Anyway, he had also been in New York in the 1940s, and he was an architect at that time. His brother was an artist. He made art as well. And in this context, he met Louise, and he met her at the studio of William Stanley Hayter, who was an English printmaker who taught Miro and many others how to make etchings. And they had an affair, a long affair. It was on and off again, but it was started very early in her marriage, and it continued into the 1950s. And so when I was there, he asked after her and said, would I please convey a message to her? And the message was, I should kiss her on the lips from him. That sealed it. So I came back. I did not kiss her on the lips. We had kissed, but not like that. Anyway, I gave her the message verbally, and she lit up like a Christmas tree, and then she shut down. And it all happened in the space of about 30 seconds. And after that, she was mistrustful of me because I knew something about her that she did not want known by the rest of the world. But it turns out it was not such a secret. In fact, people thought she'd had many more affairs than just him. I'm convinced that she really only had one big affair, and Nemesio was his name, Nemesio Antunes. I'm convinced that he was the big affair.
Let me talk to you about learning the art of the interview. What was your very first interview that you remember of any consequence?
Well, I worked for a group called the Video Data Bank in Chicago, and it was two women, Liv Blumenthal and Kate Horsfield, who established the first sort of consistent program for interviewing artists on videotape outside of the Leo Castelli archives here in New York. And so they did these tapes and they showed them to students who would otherwise not have heard directly from any artist, because in those days there was not a lot of money floating around. People didn't travel as they now do. And I was interested in their style because their style was basically without boundaries of time or space. Kate, who handled the camera work allowed the camera to roam around the face, lingering here and there, not necessarily in ways that were obviously dramatic, but that did give you a sense of the vitality of the face. And Kate and Lynn asked not long questions in her question, but questions that took a long time to answer. And I realized that looping back and leaping forward were the key to interviews, and that most interviews that you see are bound because they're basically news organizations that want specific kinds of information in a specific time slot.
They want word bites, sound bites.
They want sound bites. Yeah. I've never wanted to give a soundbite interview, and I've been asked to. And I see the frustration on my interviewer's face when I don't. I don't know if the expression is on your face now, but be prepared.
I'm laughing my rear end off. Having read the book, it's like the artists, are they, when you approach artists, are they very conscious of giving the interview that coincides with the narrative that they want to put forward to the public about who they are?
Some are and some aren't. And some artists are wisely cognizant of that because they do, in fact, have a persona that they fashion. And usually their reasons for fashioning it are informed. They're not always right, but they're informed. Artists, people are always trying to pick artists apart to find the key to their work in some kink of their personality or some freak of their experience, rather than understanding that the making of art is a mysterious thing, even to the artist.
Yep.
And that the desire to resolve that mystery is the reason we go wrong so often in trying to understand what the artist is and what the work is. So my attitude is a different one. It's like, I would like to know this person as well as they can be known through words. I'd like to assume that we will know them better or at least differently through the images or objects they make, and that the two together end up to as much intimacy as we're likely to have with pretty extraordinary people.
Is an interview therefore like a performance?
It can be. At the worst, it can be just purely that.
Okay. Yeah, I see that.
It's a kind of method acting.
You often quote literature in your interviews, which I really appreciate. But sometimes artists seem to be a little bit more not into it. There's an interview in this book with Raymond Pettibon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, is it me reading that, or did that seem like that was a little bit of a difficult interview?
It's a difficult interview because Raymond is, to all intents and purposes, autistic. And he's really not there.
Got
most
it.
Of the time. And also, at one point, we had been drinking quite a lot of vodka. So but Raymond is also a very special person because he's super smart.
Yeah.
And he reads widely. And he sometimes reads deeply as well, so that he's a word man as much as he's an image man, maybe even more so.
But he seems to not show that a lot.
No, he doesn't. But if you look at his drawings, they're
full of
literary references, either stylistically or actual quotations.
But there was a surrealistic moment in that interview where you pulled the book off the shelf and started reading poetry by William Carlos Williams.
Yes.
That was an amazing moment.
I actually can't remember it. William Carlos Williams is
well, he was being a little bit standoffish about poetry. And just sort of, he was sort of claiming like he wasn't interested in any of this, and all this, and the way it described in the interview is, you just looked over the shelf, I think it was the Norton Compendium of Poetry or something, and you just started reading reading William Carlos Williams out loud, at which point he went, wow, that is pretty good.
Well, his father was an English professor. He was in the Army, and he was a professor, and he taught English to soldiers, English American and English literature to soldiers, and then he did it at community colleges in Southern California. So initially, Raymond had these sheets of paper that were his father's test questions to these young men and women. And they're basically quotations by the various writers they were reading and questions about what the substance of that quotation, who said it and what do they mean. And so a lot of Raymond's work is based on those pull quotes American and English literature. And there are times when, you know, you'll read something, you'll say, that's Raymond Chandler, but it isn't. Or you'll say, that's Edgar Allan Poe, but it isn't. Or sometimes it is.
He also talked about how much of his work has been destroyed. And that sort of surprised me, but he was a little bit cagey about how many and by what. He originally said Hurricane Sandy, but then he said he also destroyed a lot of the work himself.
He did, and he gave a lot of it away, too. I mean, I remember visiting him in Southern California with a collector friend of mine who was very high-end. Raymond is very common, sort of not fancy. She expressed interest in some of his drawings, and she could have bought the whole room full of them, but he just gave them to her like that, just pulled them out of the pile and handed them to her.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, he doesn't value his work as precious objects, and he wants to communicate. And again, I think that's partly a function of whatever state of mind he's in. But he is very, very generous in order to continue a conversation or to make a connection, which, by the way, goes back to Only Connect, which is the famous E.M. Forster.
That's right. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Robert Storr, curator, critic, painter. From 1990 till 2002, he worked at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where he was the curator and then senior curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture. He's a professor at Yale now, and we're talking about his book, which is just superb. Robert Storr, Interviews on Art. Who's Trevor Rotz?
That's me.
You got to explain that to me.
That's my name spelled backwards, and it was done by a high school friend of mine who invented this persona. I was spelling my name backwards, substituting the B for the V in the way that they do for Havana. But the reason I did that was at that time I was not much of a critic. I was not much of a writer in any case, and I didn't want to be known as such. And I also didn't want to be known as the, the house writer about Louise Bourgeois. So having done a couple of things, I just put that in there to cover my tracks ever so slightly.
There are several interviews. Many interviews in this book, that there are moments in the interview that really, for the reader, opens up the artist as a person to me. Like, it was something that I didn't know about the person. It may have had nothing to do with their art. And I just want to give you one example. Chuck Close, which it's a wonderful interview. And he talked about walking on the street in Soho in 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And he's sort of alone in the roads, and then he passes a black man. And his quote is, "For the first time in my life, I felt someone hated me because I was white." That was an amazing thing to reveal to you.
It was, and I don't know quite what he meant about it, because I don't know that black people hated white people at that time for that reason. I mean, they had it maybe for other reasons, but in any case, it was a very revealing thing. And if you think Chuck came from a pretty white society in the northwest coast of the United States.
That's right.
And probably he was just beginning to wake up to what the streets in urban centers have been like for all of us who've lived in them most of our lives, which is that you just don't know who you're dealing with, and you don't know whether they dislike you or you dislike them for reasons. And it's not about black-white only. It can be about Hispanic-white. It can be many, many different variations. And, you know, a lot of people are afraid of the other. And the other, if you're black, is white. You know, and that's just the way it is.
He was quite revealing and so personal in the interview that, you know, first of all, having now become handicapped, and talking about that moment when he left the hospital and realized he could no longer operate the way he did before. That has to be crushing. It just has to be amazing to experience that as an artist.
Well, I saw him at just that point in the hospital when he was flat on his back. He couldn't move much of anything at that point. Eventually, he recovered partial movement of his hands and partial movement of some of his legs. But at that point, he was really just kind of out of it. And he was crushed, I mean, literally. He was incredibly ingenious and determined to recover as much as he could. And he ended up developing ways to use one hand to support the other hand. The hand that was the more mobile was the supporting hand. The hand that was the more challenged was the one in which he held the brush on a kind of, a glove that he had that had slots. And, he could use one hand to lift and maneuver the other one. And there are things he made late in his life which have great dexterity, but it's a two-handed dexterity, not one hand.
I know. It's been amazing evolution for him as an artist. But in that interview, he talks about going to the Met, and he's looking at the works of Jan van Eyck and Hans Holbein. And here are these small miniature paintings that are incredibly detailed, and he tells you, everything I loved was little and tight, and he realized he can't do that anymore.
Well, in the end, he did do some things that were little and tight, but only in small passages. He couldn't do whole paintings that were like that the way he had, except by exorbitant expenditures of time.
One of the things I really appreciate about you as an interviewer is you don't approach artists by way of how you describe as superstructural factors, as many academics do. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, many people who are trained in art history as it is currently taught are led to believe that art is just something that is tossed up by the society and the systems of society and economics, and that the individual artist has very little discretion in this matter. It used to be that it was thought the artist had all the discretion. That was the genius theory of art. I think the truth lies nowhere and somewhere in between. I think basically what successful artists do is they find the givens of their life and they make out of them something that no one could have predicted. But there's a lot of decision-making, a lot of agency that artists have, but they don't have total agency. They can't just make themselves up.
There's Richard Serra told Chuck Close that an artist is only as good as the obscurity of their sources.
Yes.
Which had me roaring when I read that. So there are definitely things that artists don't want to talk about.
Yes, but not all artists are so squeamish about their sources. And in fact, in recent years, in the years of appropriation, people were in fact making art out of their sources.
That's right.
Overtly. That again goes back to the old idea of the artist as a sui generis genius. And if you owe anything to anybody, it's a sign of your relative weakness. Now that's nuts. Right?
Thank you.
In classical times, if you think of Manet, for example, who's thought of as being this great rebel painter, he did a number of paintings which were literally based on famous old master examples, and he wanted you to note. So, and of course, in the Asian traditions, you rehearse the work of your master for decades, maybe, before you make something that is not like his work. Now, and I use the his advisedly because it was for both heavily male societies. But anyway, the point is that the idea of originality being the criteria for art is a concept of the 19th century or a concept of the Renaissance. But there's a wonderful quotation of Arshil Gorky, the Armenian-American painter, talking to de Kooning. And de Kooning, who is Dutch, was making wonderfully fresh paintings. And Gorky, who was kind of his mentor, said, your paintings look kind of original in a way that de Kooning said didn't sound like it was such a good thing. And I know the experience. I saw Peter Saul, who's 87, and he was at Skowhegan when I was a student there. And I remember him looking at my work. He said, looks kind of modern to me. And that was his way of saying, looks like shit.
Buckminster Fuller.
Yeah.
What an odd interview. His answers are hugely long.
Yes, and that was an exception among all these interviews, since that was one that was not really on my docket personally, but I was asked to do it by the video data bank people who I mentioned before, and so I did. And he, by that time, was quite aged, and he was ensconced in this office, which was sort of the brain headquarters of this institute in Philadelphia that he had. So we were meeting on very little common ground.
But his,
I was interested in him, and I studied him up a little bit, and he was, and I knew some of the things he'd done, and I was particularly interested. And I don't think it's in the interview, but he was very upset that Jasper Johns had made such a success of a painting that he had based on Fuller's Dymaxion map. And it was an enormous painting. I think it was the biggest one Jasper ever painted at that time, and it was in the members' room of the Museum of Modern Art, and this galled Fuller, I can't tell you how much, because he was a designer and he was
right.
Not a particularly successful one commercially. And here's this young artist, Jasper, who had made a huge success out of one of his ideas.
Now, we're talking about moments. There are moments in a lot of these interviews which I really feel like I got to know the artist in a personal way. Louise Bourgeois, I loved her talking about her relationship with André Breton and Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah,
the way she thought of them as anti-women in a very French way.
A very French way, particularly since Duchamp was a great ladies' man, and he never put the moves on Louise, but he did his very best to charm her out of the trees. And Breton was a notorious sexist.
It sounds it. It was absolutely amazing. I'll tell you another wild interview that sounded like you were trying to get something out of Jeff Koons.
Yeah, well, Jeff is another problem because Jeff speaks his own kind of est-inflected way of approaching him. He speaks in a language which is kind of like a kind of psychobabble. And
that came out in the interview, and it seemed like you were determined to try to get a straight answer.
And I didn't, and I can't, and no one can. I think I got some straighter answers than others have gotten, but, you know, he has a pitch to make, and his pitch is,
that's it.
I think, deeply rooted not just in his desire to sell you something, but also because that's how he keeps it together. He is a very, very febrile personality in some respects, and he is holding it together as best he can, and this jive that he talks is his way of doing it. He was a student of Ed Paschke, who was also a art professor in Chicago. And I look at him as being a successful remaking of the Chicago strange Terry Hu type artist into a dependable New York product.
Ellsworth Kelly.
Ellsworth was a man I loved. He was a fantastic guy.
But he was talking about his wartime experiences in your interview and being in Paris after the war, something that I never heard, I knew about, but I didn't know any of his personal ideas about it. That's very revelatory to me.
Yeah, he was a very, very interesting man, and he loved Paris, and he got there right at the liberation of France, and they went back there on the GI Bill.
A lot of your interviews also are just useful to thinking about art in general. Bryce Marden. Talked a lot in your interview about what abstract means, what postmodernism means, what formalism means. I found that like a lecture by Bryce, and it was great.
Yeah. First of all, Bryce went to Yale. He also went to, I forget what it is, BU, I think. And, you know, he is a well-educated artist, and he is pretty terse. But he knows a lot. He's thought a lot. So if you can draw him out, which is not easy, but if you can draw him out, he has a lot to say. And it's very thoughtful.
It's really intelligent. It was really, really brilliant. So there is no postmodernism?
Well, I don't think there is, no.
Okay.
I think postmodernism is a kind of spasm in the history of modernism, sort of identity crisis in the middle of modernism.
Again, there's so many moments. Going back to Chuck Close, I think it was him that was talking about sitting in the old Heidelberg bar where the abstractionists used to get drunk with Jack Twerkoff and Philip Guston. Watching them get drunk and complaining about not selling their work.
Well, the Heidelberg was across the street from the School of Art, or down the block anyway, and it was in New Haven, not in New York. And these two guys, that is Torkoff and Guston, were sort of the also-rans of abstract expressionism at that time. Both did very well in the long run, but both of them were sort of in pauses in their careers. And when people get in their cups, they tend to tell you what's bothering them. That's what he heard. And for a young student to meet these legendary figures and realize that they, too, weren't quite sure how it was all going to turn out was probably very revelatory.
Now, in the introductory interview with you, you talk about the odd and the grotesque. About that's appealing to you.
Yeah, well, the grotesque is I think the third category of art. I mean, people talk about the third section. Well, I think grotesque is kind of the third category of art.
Wait, what are the first? Give me the first two.
The first two? Well, the classic and the modern.
Okay, and then the grotesque. Then, but the grotesque as a theme has gone all the way through art, the history of art.
Right, exactly. And it's one version. It would be the sort of the systems based proportionate classical model, and the other version would be the Baroque, Rococo, and then other things since then. But the grotesque is where it's all jammed together, it's all happening at the same time, and where you can't line up opposites in easy patterns, and you can't resolve in favor of one or the other definitively. You're always coming back and biting your tail.
Okay, we're almost out of time, and I have to ask you this. Are you still making your own work?
Well, I've gone back to it at a kind of recklessly late age. So the answer is
I couldn't find any examples of them to look at. What kind of work do you do?
I do abstract paintings. I do very simple geometric abstract paintings, but not based on sort of pure geometric forms, but I invent them on the surface.
Isn't it difficult for you to do that after being so familiar with and intimately familiar with so many artists and their work?
A candid answer is yes, but not because I know other artists' work. It's difficult for me to do it because it's just plain difficult.
Have you shown?
Yeah, and I've even sold. I was in a show a couple of years ago that was at the National Academy of Arts and Letters, or American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the painting sold this in the collection of the Amherst College Museum of Art. So I do once in a while.
As you write about, as it said in the introductory essay, art is something that you must do. It's not like a hobby. It's like when you're done with your work, you got to do the art.
Yes. And since art is something that only you need until you actually realize it, you have to spend a lot of your time just sitting and waiting, not for inspiration, but for clarity about what you are going to do.
I want to talk to you later sometime about your work. My returning guest tonight is Robert Storr, curator, critic, painter from 1990 until 2002. He worked at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where he was curator and then senior curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture. And he teaches painting at Yale University now. Robert, it's been a pleasure. I love this book. I think it's a real eye-opener for people to get to know these artists in a very intimate way.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad that's what comes through.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.